said it's working all right, and it looks like...
What's it supposed to do?
Well, this is the microphone right there, and it's picking up very well, so I think...
You mean if I talk away?
Oh, yes,
you can hear it.
Oh, yes, yes. Get started then. Let's begin by, for the record, this is Jim Boning from the Beckman Center in Philadelphia talking with Dr. Charles D. Hurd at his home in Evanston. Today is February 28th, 1991, and with me are Dr. Alfred Bader and his wife Isabel. Dr. Hurd, I know you were born on May 7th, 1897 in Utica. Could you tell me something about your parents and your family background?
Yes. My father was born in 1850, and he had a first wife with three boys, and she died, and he married my mother, who was born in 1875, 25 years younger than he was. They had two children. I have an older sister born in 1895. My mother married him in 1892. Well, he was a jobber of shoes. Had a retail shoe store in Utica, but wholesale within distance that they could reach. In those days, there were no automobiles, so they used trains and things. And I imagine that he met my mother on one of those wholesale trips, because her home was in Colossus, New York. You've never heard of it. You probably haven't ever heard of Paris or Mexico either. Well, a map would help. By New York State here. Here we are. Here is Utica over here, Syracuse, and 25 miles up from there is Mexico and Parrish. Can you locate them?
Mm-hmm.
It's about 15 miles east of Oswego. All right, Colossus is right between those two towns.
Okay.
It's only a crossroad farming community, but that's where she was born, and she got married, as I indicated, and had the two kids, and then he died of typhoid fever before I was a year old. Well, she wasn't able to handle those stepsons. The oldest one was only a few years younger than she was. So she went back to Colossus, and to help out paying the bills, she actually got a job teaching in the grade schools in Mexico. And there she met her husband had already died, the older man. So I didn't ever know my father at all. And while she was alive, I was stupid not to ask her quite a lot about him, but I didn't. So I don't know anything except he had a home in Utica and he sold shoes. He was the sixth of eight children. The oldest one was named DeWitt, and my middle name is named after the oldest one. DeWitt was named after the governor of New York State that built the Erie Canal, namely DeWitt Clinton. In other words, these days they sort of imitate names just like they did in the old days. But I got named after him. He was also in shoes. If they hadn't died, I'd probably be in shoes. Who knows? But he died, and in Mexico, the the both grade school and the high school was all under the same roof in a pretty big building. And of course, she met the principal, whose name was A.H. Norton, Arthur H. Norton. And he really is my father. That is, they married when I was age 5, and lived in Mexico for a few years until 1904, when he got a call to be principal of Cook Academy in Montour Falls, New York. Now, Montour Falls is the new name of that town. It had been named Havana, but there was a Colonel Cook that was sort of a politician in the town, and he didn't like the name, and he's the one that built Cook Academy, and anything he wanted to happen, well, he disliked the name Havana, and so he picked out the name Montour Falls. There's no falls in the world that is called Montour Falls, just the town. It has a that area is a bunch of waterfalls and glens. 3 miles to the north of Montour Falls is Watkins. Mm-hmm. That's at the south end of Seneca Lake, which is really a tremendous lake. It's one of the deepest lakes in the whole continental United States, only 3 miles wide and 40 miles long, but about 600 feet deep. There's a Watkins Glen, but there still is a Havana Glen. In 1904, you paid 10 cents if you wanted to go and see either one. Now, 10 cents would buy 2 loaves of bread. That's better than you can buy one loaf for now at $1.50. That tells you that was a high price if you wanted to go and see either Havana or Watkins Glen.
Your sister was with you.
Hmm?
Your sister was with you. You had an older sister.
An older sister. That's right. And when she married A.H. Norton, I got two half-sisters that lived with me. Those half-sisters, I don't think, ever met my half-brothers. They were all in Utica, and I wasn't. Mother was totally French. Her grandparents were French immigrants, and her father was a French immigrant. French was something that he never learned. So French was the language of the home in Colossus, New York. She had to learn English when she went to the first grade.
Was French or French Canadian?
No, French from France. She, in other words, her parents came from the western end of France, very close to Switzerland. And you hear about French being Catholics and drinking wine. These were Baptists, and they had no wine. I have an idea that maybe they left France because of persecution by the Catholics. But in any event, that's her history. She took piano. Up on the farm, they had a melodeon like this that you pumped, but the thing actually had a keyboard that looked like a piano, and she actually was a pretty good pianist, really. A.H. Norton there got this call to come to Cook Academy, which he accepted, and his job, it was a boarding school, a co-education, his job was to fill up those rooms. Floor 2 was female, floors 3 and 4 was male. And one day he got a communication from the Chinese ambassador. I don't think I have his name accurately, so I'm not going to mention it, but he was told to get the best academy in the whole United States because these were going to be the first 4 boys ever to come here from China to get the education necessary to go to college here. Well, he didn't know anything about American high schools, that Chinese ambassador. He had his high school work in China. But he knew a sophomore at Cornell named Alfred Z. So he wrote him. And he didn't know anything about him either, but he had an American roommate. And he asked him where the best one was. Well, he named Cook Academy, where he came from, only 20 miles to the west of Ithaca. And thus was the best high school chosen. The father learned afterwards that if he had turned it down, they were going to close the school up.
Well, you went to Cook Academy, but did you have any schooling before you went there?
Well, I had grades 1 and 2 in Mexico. I had grades 3 to 7 in Montour Falls Grade School. I had grade 8 in Cook Academy because Father thought it was going to be simply better that way. And I had my first two high school years in Cook Academy. So I was at Cook really for 3 years, plus that was our home. And he had a call from Cook Academy to become a professor of mathematics and astronomy at Elmira College, which now is co-ed, but at that time it was altogether female. And he was there about 2 years, and the president appointed him vice president of Elmira. And afterwards, while he was at Elmira, there was World War I, and he was on a leave of absence while he was the vice president to go over to France and hand out coffee and donuts to the boys in a YMCA hut that he was head of, very close to the front lines. And while he was there, he got a letter asking him if he would consider being president of Cuker College that was going to be newly reopened under entirely different auspices. Now, Cuker annoys me right now because they advertised founded in 1890. What was founded in 1890 was Cuker Institute, a high school. The Reverend George Ball very badly wanted to have a college, but he would simply run into debt every year, and his three nephews bailed him out. They were the Balls of Muncie, Indiana, that make fruit jars. Mm-hmm. So they had some cash with which to do it. And let's see now. He had a college started about 1896. That was the first of the Cuker colleges. It never was really going. That is, in other words, I think it actually lasted until about 1912. I don't think they had more than 40 graduates. They'd take 2 years there and they'd go to Syracuse or Cornell to get a degree from a respectable institution.
But it still exists now.
Hmm?
It still exists now.
Yes, but not that one. It is the very same original building that's there. It's a big building. But the present Cuker College is one that Father accepted after the other one had been actually dead for about 4 years. The other one was coeducational. The one that opened was female, like he had at Elmira. He said that's the only way he would actually take it, and he thought he could make that go. And it was sort of started by the New York State Baptists, who put up part of the money. But he had already gotten a pretty big amount, and that was a year that the Baptists persuaded him to put what he had raised into the whole total that they were had, and they would of course get it back plus more. What he got back was about two-thirds as much as he put in. It's the worst thing that happened to him. He was scrounging for a while just to keep alive. You have to be real careful about the Baptists. Well, in any event, he did come back, and his first daughter, my older half-sister, was the first one that registered. He proudly proclaimed that. Now, in starting that particular school, he didn't want any antagonism with the old Tuca people. As a matter of fact, he wanted them to do all the help that they could, and many of them were in that Tuca Park area. Tuca Park is a town 4 miles south of Penyan. Penyan is at the south end of Tuca Lake. Tuca is the Indian word for crooked. That's the only one of the Finger Lakes that's crooked, shaped like a Y. All the rest are straight up and down. Well, let's see.
I would like to ask you a little bit about your early education and some of your experiences.
I've already there told you that I had my grade school first in Mexico and finished at Montour Falls, the last year of which was in Cook Academy. And then I went to Elmira Free Academy in the city of Elmira. That's where Father moved to. But I took a postgraduate year in high school because they didn't think I was heavy enough to go away to college. So I was in high school really for 5 years, and I found myself pretty well prepared for college.
What kind of experiences did you have, let's say, in high school, especially science-related experiences?
In high school? Well, in Elmira, I had chemistry and physics and mathematics all under very good teachers. I think the physics teacher is the best one I ever had. Well, no, there's a chemistry one in college, but of the high school ones, he was certainly the best. And chemistry wasn't bad either. I had John W. Kern, K-E-R-N, in chemistry, and he afterwards got a job teaching at Mercer University in Georgia. And he didn't know what I was doing, but at that particular time I was completing a PhD program at Minnesota. Well, partly there, I completed it with Princeton. But he wrote me by way of my parents that he'd like to have me come down and help him teaching. He would take a year off and start work on his PhD at Illinois, and after I had that, I could also, if I wanted, I could go to graduate school. Well, I had to reply to him that I was already in graduate school. The first job that I had was at Urbana after graduating with Princeton, and Kern was there as a graduate student, and I was teaching.
The reversal of roles.
Yeah.
How well, did you get to Minnesota and then Princeton?
Well,
could we back up for just a moment, because
yes.
I'd like to pursue a little bit more about your first chemistry. Was that your first exposure to science, or had you had any anything previous to that?
Well, I'd had so-called grade school science, which didn't amount to much, but I at least recall sitting in a classroom where I had it.
And when you took the chemistry, did you sort of feel at that point that chemistry, physics, or math, the science area, was what you were really interested in?
Cause no.
I'm sure you had the classics and literature and history as well.
Now, college you're talking about now?
No, we're still, but before you get to Syracuse.
High school.
Yes.
No, I liked them all. I hadn't really made a choice as to which one I would take because of the high school courses I took.
Then Why did you select Syracuse for your undergraduate work?
Well, father went there, and I would imagine he kind of thought it was a pretty good place for me to go. After all, it has to be the best one, you know.
And did you?
I ought to have actually gone to Western Ontario. Isn't that where you went?
No. Queens.
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 Western Ontario, London?
Yeah.
Not a bad school.
When you went to Syracuse, did you select chemistry as a major initially?
No, I took it because you had to take a science, but I took both chemistry and physics, and I took geology in my graduate year in high school, as a matter of fact, or geography, I guess they called it, and then I took some geology on top of that for 1 year with Syracuse. I also took a course in astronomy.
When did you make the decision to become a chemistry major?
When I had a course in organic chemistry under Reginald S. Beener, Crandon, Canada. He is probably the best teacher I ever had. B-O-E-H-N-E-R.
What was the chemistry department like at Syracuse when you were there?
Well, it was pretty good from a teaching point of view. It was not very good from a research point of view. I hope they're getting better, but at that time there was one person that I think thought he was doing something, but as a teaching school, though, they had good teachers. I had H.C. Cooper in physical. I had Merritt Leroy Gross in analytical, and as a matter of fact, he's a brother of Professor Gross of the history department here, who just recently died. But I think that our history professor is a better teacher than his brother at Syracuse. I'm not putting down that he was awful, but he certainly was nothing like Professor Beener.
Syracuse now is really has two different schools very close to each other. Was that the same then? You know, you have the University of Syracuse, and then you have the State University of New York in Syracuse.
Well, that's the same thing.
Well, they're separate now.
Well, they have the same campus. Let's put
adjoining,
it that way.
Adjoining, yes.
That is the legal aspects of it. I haven't kept up with it, but the campus. They've got a pretty big campus. I think they've got one of the best forestry departments in the world.
Yeah. Yes. Michael Schwartz. Mm-hmm.
Yes, yes. I did an interview with him.
Well, Michael Schwartz.
Yes.
He's a fun guy.
Yes, yes. What kind of laboratory work did you do? Especially in organic.
Well, it was just the organic course, elementary organic, and you did the laboratory that was part of that course.
Synthesis? Did you mostly synthesis?
Yes, there's separations or purifications. Mm-hmm. Probably it's taught about the same way yet.
You remember any textbooks that you may have used?
Yes. There was a Holloman Cooper that was used in inorganic chemistry that I took there. That was the Cooper that was a professor there. Mm-hmm. He didn't write the book. He translated it from Holloman over there, I think to the Netherlands, but I'm not sure. He also put out an organic book, but I didn't ever have that one.
What was it about organic that struck you, that interested you?
Perhaps the way it was taught, but it appealed to me because it overlapped so much of what we actually all do.
Mm-hmm. Did you do any kind of research as a senior, as your last year?
No. That began at Minnesota. However, World War I was on, And the day after I actually graduated from Syracuse, I was taking the train to Washington, because what they had was the poison gas problem. And that was part of the infantry, so they actually started a chemical service section. That's what it's called, and CSS. What we have now is Chemical Warfare Service, but that was a development out of that. And they had a research division. And they had trouble filling it up because the chemists that were already in jobs like teaching or industry didn't want to simply throw those away and then discover that when the war was over, they wouldn't have a job. So they kind of leaned very heavily on the graduating seniors. And I was happy to do it, because that actually was a job. And I arrived there, and it took me about half an hour to get from where I was at the end of the line up to the desk where I could become a buck private. And in that half hour, I got pretty well acquainted with the person right behind me. He was doing the same thing from the University of Georgia. His name was Alfred Scott. And, what we were doing was told that they had no Army camp for us there, but we had commutation, which means money for which we buy our own room and board. Well, Alfred and I talked it over and found we were pretty compatible with each other. We said, well, how about looking up a room together? That will save money, which it did. So we got a room there in Chevy Chase, Maryland, which was pretty close to where we had to work. And I went to the American University, and he went to the Catholic University, where they had a few rooms open, not many. But the American University had a campus already built that had never been used yet as a school. So the Army just took it over. And I was under M.F. Coolball and Gerald Wendt at that time. They were a pretty prominent chemist. Coolball came from Colorado, and there's a Coolball Hall up there that's named after him. And Wendt at the time was at the University of Chicago with physical chemistry, and I was under him. I was in the inorganic division of the research section. What do you know about that?
What kind of work were you doing?
Making some actual chemicals that were war gases for others to use and test, and purifying some that weren't pure enough.
This was 1918,
for half a year, and I thought I was pretty good there at the time that I began. My God, that was the best bunch of chemists in the United States. It was there, J.B. Conant, for example, Roger Adams. And so I was under L.W. Jones, really, who was not in the Army at all. He was a civilian that was put in charge of offense research. Offense research is poison gas. Arthur B. Lamb was put in defense research, that means gas masks. Well, I was in the offense part, so fundamentally I was under him, but I was way up. I didn't ever see him. But half a year afterwards at the armistice, Alfred Scott and I both decided that we would go on for graduate work. And we hunted him up and asked him if he would take us. I think we must have been the first two that asked him. He said, yes, we'd be glad to, if we paid our own way. before I got a teaching appointment there, teaching assistantship. And then that changed to a DuPont fellow, which put me on full-time research. And then I was there 2 years under him. That L.W. Jones is the one that I had at both the Army and the University of Minnesota, where he was the dean. He didn't ever enter the Army. He did his work there as a civilian. In 2 years, though, he got an offer to transfer to Princeton. So he took me along to Princeton as a graduate student, also Alfred Scott, and we continued to room together there at Princeton. And it was about 2 years after I began to know Alfred Scott that I discovered he had some additional experience. At Minnesota, he'd say, "Charles, what do you say we walk over to the gym and shoot a few baskets?" Well, he could shoot a few baskets. I could hardly pick the ball up off the floor. But one day we were there, and the coach of the team was there, named Doc Cook. He was an MD that didn't ever practice. He was just an athletic director. Came over to me. He said, "Who's that boy?" I said, he's a graduate student in chemistry." Oh, that meant he couldn't use him. I discovered afterwards that he was the best player the South had ever produced, and he's in the Basketball Hall of Fame.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, why couldn't they use him?
Hmm?
Why could he not use him?
Because he was not an undergraduate.
Oh, I see.
They could certainly have used him as an undergraduate. Actually, that was the year that Minnesota had the Big Ten championship of 10 victories and no defeats. At the end of the season, four of them, plus Alfred, toured Minnesota playing amateur baseball, for which they might have a handkerchief that they would sell for $25. But he was the best one in that group of five. To tell you that he was pretty good.
Yes.
Well, he went back to become the chairman of the University of Georgia. It was in pretty sad state until the older ones died off, but he's the one that really is responsible for having it be a pretty good school now in chemistry.
This is in Athens.
Hmm?
In Athens.
In Athens, yes. That was his home. He died a few years ago, I think, of smoking.
You did some work back when you were in Syracuse with Edison.
Yeah.
In the summer of 17. How did that come about?
Well, a father thought that I should do something because of World War I in the summer vacation that was coming up. And he knew that Mr. Edison was the chairman of the Naval Consulting Board. So he just simply wrote him and asked him if he had a place for me for the 3 months of the summer. Perhaps I could help in the military some way or other. And his secretary, William H. Meadowcroft, wrote back and said, "Yes, send them on. We'll pay them $15 a week." That's not a day or an hour. That's a week. And the task that I was put in, I was put in a team of about four or five that would take an automobile up the Orange Mountains towards Morristown, but not quite to Morristown, and that's was an open hayfield then that they were able to get. And what they had was the problem of where is that shotgun, or where is that cannon, or where is that stick of dynamite. And they actually went at it by triangulation. Have a baseline with three of those ediphones on it that are wax records, and at the baseline were the microphones that transmitted that sound to three pins that would make an indentation in a revolving wax record. And then under a microscope, the difference between the three indentations made by the three pins could be translated into yards or miles or whatnot. We ultimately got pretty good. If we would take temperatures in that area and take wind velocities in that area, in other words, the speed of sound isn't anything at all. The speed of light is pretty slow, relatively, and you had to make the corrections, otherwise it wouldn't work.
Did you meet Edison at all?
Oh, yes. He was there. We'd ordinarily meet in a room and come back to that room, and he'd ordinarily be there and talk to the person that headed it up, and he was hard of hearing at that time, and a high-pitched voice, maybe for that reason, you could overhear much of what they were talking about, but his favorite word was rotten. I have an idea he didn't think we were doing too well. I of course was only there for the 3 months of the vacation, and then I went back to complete the college. But it was at that place, though, that was in West Orange, and they had a Baptist church that was in Orange, but it was called North Orange Baptist Church. There's an East and a South and a West Orange, but no West Orange, no North Orange except for that church. And there I met the lady that ultimately became my wife 3 years later after I earned a PhD. 4 years later.
Yes, you were married in
1921,
wasn't it? Yes, 21.
So I was 29. How's that?
Yes. So you corresponded with her. She lived in New Jersey? And
she lived in New Jersey. She was in the Trimble Hat Company. Orange at that time was quite a hat center. And Trimble hats were as good as Stetson hats. And she was with the Trimbles.
So you kept up a lot. Well, you came back to Princeton in a few years, so you were closer to that.
I was only at Princeton 1 year, but that was considerably closer than Minnesota. And once in a while we would meet. And it was during that year that I proposed to her if she was willing to wait.
And you were pretty close to your stepfather. Mm-hmm. Your stepfather took very good care of you, I take it. Your stepfather was very close to you.
He didn't have much money, but he at least was sure that somehow or other I was going to school. Well, at that time, New York State had a state scholarship system with which the highest five students in any scholarship district would get a scholarship of $100 a year. Well, I happened to be in that category. The districts were, in essence, counties. In other words, my home was in Schuyler County. In the metropolitan areas, though, it was not. That is, they'd have it broken up in New York City, Brooklyn, Syracuse, Rochester, into several scholarship districts. But I was in a rather poorly populated, well, the biggest town was Elmira, and all the rest were quite little, like Montour Falls. But that helped. And Father said he didn't know how he could have arranged it if I hadn't got that $100 a year for all 4 years. At least I had to be aware of it a few years ago, and at that time it was 150. I don't know what it is now. Probably it's $200 or $300, but it was a tremendous help to our family. And I sold Fuller brushes to help out also in the summertime. That was up around, between Utica and Ogdensburg, and mm-hmm. took that trip on foot.
My gosh.
And really made quite a lot of money.
Well, there was a lot of door-to-door selling going on in those days.
Evidently. The other one that was big was aluminum. That was quite new and hadn't reached the stores yet, so people were punching doorbells.
You mean aluminum siding?
Mm-hmm.
Aluminum sidings?
I think that came afterwards, but this was stuff for the kitchen.
Pots and pans.
Yeah.
When you were in Minnesota with Jones, did you take any courses, or was it?
Yes, that was my first year in graduate school. I took the freshman chemistry over again. My high school teacher, Dr. Kern, thought I was foolish to do it, but I took freshman physics over, and I took freshman chemistry over, and the first math I took was analytical geometry. That was under Dr. Metzler. There were two Metzlers in the math department. I had the poor one, his older brother. The other one's the head of the department. I asked him a question once that I got that was unrelated to analytical department. He said, I'll ask some other people in the department on this. Of course, I knew his brother. He couldn't have asked.
I have a list of some of the faculty at Minnesota. McKay was the chairman of the department at the time.
Leroy Wiley McKay. That's right. I didn't ever have anything under him. But I had courses under M.C. Sneed. William H. Hunter was my first organic. That was the first organic course I took, was under Hunter, and then I had another one under Jones.
When you started your research with Jones, did he assign the problem to you?
No, with him first I had a course of organic preps. That was not research yet, and then after I had that, then. At that time I hadn't picked out anybody yet. That is, I was just under him because that was a course he was teaching. But then I asked him if he would take me, and he seemed happy to do so.
What kind of a person was he?
I'd say wonderful. He was easygoing in a way. But if he said something was going to be done, it was done. And he was very popular, I think.
When did Kohlthoff come to
Kohlthoff was there also. McKay and Kohlthoff were both in analytical.
Did you get to know him well?
No. You see, I didn't have any analytical there.
I knew
who he was, but he probably had no idea who I was.
Kohlthoff is still there.
Yeah, he's very good, too. McKay was at Princeton, wasn't he?
Yes, I'm sorry, I looked at the wrong list of people. He was at Princeton.
Yeah, he was at Princeton. And he, if you were a graduate student, you had to prove that you knew some analytical chemistry. If they were from Princeton, as many of them were, he knew that they were pretty good, so they didn't have to do anything. But coming as a transfer there from the University of Minnesota, I had to prove it. He handed me a mineral and told me to analyze it. Well, I told him it was pretty much antimony, but or trace of arsenic in it. It was stibnite. He said, well, you can analyze that for arsenic. he said, and as much as you were an organic chemist, though, I'll tell you that you can analyze it by the Emil Fischer method. If you don't know what the Emil Fischer method is, you can look it up, same as I can. But in essence, they're converting to the chloride distillation. Mm-hmm. But it took me a month out of the last year of my graduate program. I was only at Princeton for half a year, according to Dean Andrew Flamingo West, 49 inches around the vest, because as a teaching assistant at Princeton, on his books, I was only there at half time. But Jones had made arrangements with the faculty, if he was going to come, there wasn't going to be any handicap in graduating at the same time I would have if I'd stayed at Minnesota. And it's a good thing he insisted on that, because I was only there half a year, and he dearly wanted to have me there a whole year at least, so that I'd know there's something at Princeton. That would have been 2 years, you see.
Did you get the PhD from Minnesota or from Princeton?
From Princeton. Under the same man, L.W. Jones.
How much of your work had you done at Minnesota, the laboratory work?
Well, a pretty heavy amount of it.
Yeah, I was interested in that paper which came out of your PhD thesis, because you were, well, there were two things. One, given your interest in nomenclature, many, many years later, you were actually still struggling with naming things in that very first paper with Jones.
Yeah.
You still are now.
But that's what struck me, is that back in 1922, when that paper was published, or 21, you were already suggesting prefixes and trying to sort out nomenclature of some of those acids. And the other was that you were already looking at what later became some very important mechanistic organic chemistry. You were relating the rearrangement to the stability of the radical, and that was pretty new at that time to start thinking in
those
terms, wasn't it?
Actually, it'll interest you what happens here. As you know, Moses Gomberg had isolated the triphenylmethyl radical. So Jones was after me to make triphenyl acetyl hydroxamic acid, which would rearrange with the triphenylmethyl group. And would it be very much easier, or would it? Well, it was a trifle easier, but not awfully much so. But in that particular process, I also made diphenyl acetohydroxamic acid from diphenyl acetic acid, ester and hydroxylamine. But then all that was was simply a repetition. All of the compounders knew, the method was not. It was simply an ester plus hydroxylamine give the hydroxamic acid. But to do something new, I decided to make it from diphenyl ketene, which had been made of only half a dozen years earlier. And that worked excellently also. But that put me on what I was planning to do at the University of Illinois when I got there, because ketene its own self was comparatively new, and I said, well, I'm going to see if I can get ketene and have it at with hydroxylamine. Well, it took me quite a while to get the ketene. You heat acetone hot enough. Schmidlin and Bergman had produced it by heating acetone to about 650 degrees, which is just on the borderline of whether it'll decompose or not. It took me pretty close to half a year before I could actually get it. You see, on that, what we had was a tube and a combustion furnace. And you pass the acetone vapors over some old broken up chips in the tube, and then you get ketene coming out at the other end, which you collect by having it pass into water or alcohol or ammonia or things like that. And but that got me into the chemistry of ketenes, which I would not have done it at all if it hadn't been for that dissertation work that involved a ketene. And also, though, the trouble that I had in heating that hot enough got me into high temperature decomposition reactions. And in two ways, one, both experimentally, and then I decided to author a book, because I discovered there wasn't any such book. And there, well, a friend of mine there at Harvard heard I was doing it, namely Kona, and he wrote and said, well, I've got a name for it, pyrolysis. So he's the one that coined the name, really.
I see.
And it turned out that I pursued it a little bit.
Just a little.
Charles, can I put some coffee on? Could I make a cup of coffee?
Sure, I'll show you how.
Well, I probably know. Can I go in there?
Sure, you know. Show me the equipment. Now, where were we?
Well, we were just finishing up your work at Princeton. I wanted to ask you, as you were, as that was drawing to a close, if you had thought about an industrial career versus an academic career.
Yeah. Actually, as a matter of fact, I thought that probably it would have to be an industry. But then at that time, W.A. Noyes had written to Princeton asking if have they got anybody that they can recommend. I think two of us went there.
Who was the other one?
Harvey Neville.
Oh, yes, sure.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember, isn't the Lehigh Chemistry Building the Neville Chemistry Building? I think at Lehigh University
that's where he transferred to.
Yes, because I think their building is named after him, the chemistry building at Lehigh.
Well, Illinois hired about six people that year. One was in their problem of sewage and things like that, the department that handles that. Two of us were in organic. One was in physical, that's Phipps. The other one that was a woman was, I mean, inorganic was a woman. Her name, I ought to know it. Haven't heard much of her. She actually transferred to Vassar.
What was Illinois like when you got there? What were you assigned to do?
Well, I was teaching freshman chemistry with B.S. Hopkins for 2 years, and then I was transferred into the organic where I worked more with Marvel and Adams. As a matter of fact, I had Adams' office for my office for 1 year because he was, that year he was in Europe. And I had the laboratory also next to him, and the only other person in the laboratory was Wallace Carruthers.
Really?
Yeah. So we got to know who we were if we passed down the street. But you know, he was kind of a funny fellow. Didn't want to talk much while he was working.
Anything else with Carruthers or with Adams or Marvel? What kind of interactions did you have with them?
Well, fundamentally, I was doing my own research, and I, of course, knew who they had under them, but I had nothing to do with what they were doing.
Did you consult with, talk to them at all about your research and what you were doing?
Talk with who?
With Adams or Marble?
No. Well, except they actually knew what I was doing, and they had a plan of having the people talk to the faculty on what they are doing. One day it was my turn, and afterwards Adams came up and told me that he thought I was doing pretty well.
Did you have at that time already a laboratory making chemicals for Eastman Kodak?
No, that was Marvel. Later. Marvel and Adams were involved there. I was not. That was sort of a way that they paid their graduate students pretty much there in the summertime, particularly. They'd stay there and work full time for full pay.
That's why the deliveries of Kodak in September were much better than in March.
I see.
You have published, at least 7 papers out of that work at Illinois, mostly dealing with pyrolysis and things
related. Well, I was on ketenes there too,
yes.
I think.
Because you really developed the best way of making ketene compared to what had been in the literature up to that point.
Well, it was an 11% yield according to the work of Schmidlin and Bergman. After a half year, I was able to get that up to about 17 or 18% by heating it to 700 instead of 650. Mm. But heating it that hot was not conventional those days. That is, in other words, a combustion furnace will hardly do it. So I got some help in the chemical engineering department about making a tube that was not for analytical purposes, but was for passing things through it that are pretty hot. And that worked. That was the way that we actually there got it up to about 17. But then one of my students decided to have a ketene lamp, and that put it up to about 90% yield of the part that decomposed. And we had a chromel wire that was heated to glowing, and then in underneath was simply a bucket of acetone that was boiling, and the vapors passed up through that on the way out, and then you'd pass the ketene into what you wanted it to work with. And that is the only way to make ketene, I think, yet, because it gives a good yield.
Mm-hmm. Did you do much work with diketene also?
Yeah.
I remember when I sent in a paper to Marshall Gates showing that diketene forms an adduct with acetone.
Right.
He wrote back to me and he said, well, you probably saw the correspondence in 52, saying it's hard to believe because after all the work of Hurd and the work of Union Carbide, if it really did form an adduct with acetone, they would know about it.
Well, we didn't. But you did.
Well, bit of luck. And in all those years, of course, there was a doubt where the double bond was.
Mm-hmm.
First poem sold by NMR, Herb Gutowski.
Well, you see, here's an old Keating man, too. Perhaps you're an acetone man.
You mentioned the graduate students that you had at Illinois, and I wanted to ask you how, I counted at least five, and you were there only 3 years. I wanted to ask you how it was attracting graduate students, given that Adams and Marvel were there, how in 3 years you had five graduate students.
Not necessarily. I had perhaps that many that worked with me, but most of them were seniors.
I see.
Okay. In other words, my first one was Paul Cochran,
mm-hmm.
and I've kept in touch with him ever since Christmas Cards Yet.
Really?
No, he actually is the one that got the Keating thing moving. And then I had a person that lives in Cicero here yet. Oh, God, I know his name. Cocor.
Mm-hmm.
He heads up the Cocor Chemical Company. And then I had a person that was a senior, but he became a graduate student. He actually transferred up here with me.
At that point, Illinois was the best school in the country.
Well, it certainly was a big one and a good one, yeah. Northwestern was quite young. That is, in other words, this institution is old, going to the 1850s, but the chemistry department began in 1920 with W. Lee Lewis, who was part of the Army, I think. That is, he was here as an associate professor when World War I came on, and he was transferred to the Army at the Catholic University of America. And the problem that he had that was assigned to him, he was also in offense research by L.W. Jones, was prepare some new vesicant that has arsenic in the molecule. That'll probably make it more poisonous. He wasn't getting anywhere at all. And he was talking about it to the Catholic priest one day that taught chemistry at the Catholic University. And he said, you know, I remember about 6 or 8 years ago, we had a boy here that was earning his PhD by studying acetylene. And one of the things he passed it into was arsenic trichloride, and he got the most god-awful mess that he decided not to do anything at all to purify it, just to write up as a page in his dissertation and go about doing some more pleasant things. Well, that was just what Lewis, sir, wanted to know. So that afternoon he got a tank of acetylene and passed it in through arsenic trichloride. Nothing happened. Just bubbled in and bubbled out. He went back to the priest and told him that. Oh, yes, I remember. He also had some anhydrous aluminum chloride there. And thus was the birth of Lewisite. That person with acetylene was Father Newland.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Who earned his PhD there, and then he went to Notre Dame with all the rest of his life on acetylene.
Mm-hmm.
A charming man, too. Did you ever know him?
No.
Well, he was really, I think, one of the best. You probably knew him, didn't you?
Well, I heard him. He didn't know me. I knew him.
Yeah.
Did you have interactions with him?
With Newland? Well, only as an organic chemist.
Mm-hmm.
That is, he was at Notre Dame and I was here, and he had me down once to give a chemical talk.
When you went to Illinois, what was your position? Were you an assistant professor?
I was an instructor.
Instructor.
Yeah. And I stayed that all 3 years I was there, and I got moved up here to be an assistant professor. If I had stayed there, Marvel told me that I'd be promoted probably to an associate. They had that rank there. I don't know if they do yet. It's a rank we don't have. In between instructor and assistant professor.
How did that move up here come about?
Well, by hiring a van.
No, I meant...
How did they twist you out?
Keeping me on my toes here. Were you looking for someplace else? Were you looking to get out of Illinois?
No. As a matter of fact, I even was thinking about not accepting it. But what had happened was, at the University of Minnesota, L.W. Jones had brought up Frank Whitmore for his teaching there at Rice Institute. He had earned a PhD at Harvard, and then he went to Rice for a year, and Jones got him the next year as an assistant professor. And he transferred here at the request of W. Lee Lewis when the previous head of the department here, a guy named Young, that had never done anything, he resigned and died about 2 years later. So he had to have a replacement for Professor Young. He did never have a doctorate degree. He sort of there shopped around at 3 or 4 colleges in Europe, but never actually stayed anywhere to get a degree. But that made the opening for having Whitmore here. Well, Lewis and Whitmore both had grants from the American Petroleum Institute, and pardon me, that is not right. Let's get this straight now. I think they applied to the Public Health Institute at Washington to get funds with which to do some work on arsenic as a medicinal, because he had recalled that Ehrlich, 10 years earlier, had published on Selvarsan, arsphenamine 606, as the best drug there for their curing gonorrhea, syphilis, and they were able to get that. Whitmore even asked for it because of his work on mercury, and Lewis asked for it because of his work there on lewisite, and that put some cash in the hands of the department with which they could attract some graduate students. That's the way they got it. Well, in 1924, Lewis decided that he would resign to become the director of the Institute of American Meat Packers down at the stockyards, and that left an opening. But you see, Whitmore had known me at Minnesota, because he was there at the same time I was there as a graduate student, and probably that's the reason that he went down to Illinois and see if I could come up here for a vacancy to take the place of Lewis, not the title, just teach organic. He taught freshman chemistry in the main.
Well, but the decision must have been difficult because Illinois was such a superb school. Northwestern is a very good school today, but it wasn't then.
It wasn't then, that's right. No, what they had here in organic, Lewis and Whitmore, but Lewis left, so I had the organic. And they had Ward Evans, a charming personality, but not really a great physical chemist. But he was a raconteur par excellence. No, the institution was got kind of weak in research.
Well, you made an enormous difference.
Well, Whitmore did, really. He was the dynamic person that got things going here. And he and I both applied after we came here for the American Petroleum Institute grant. That's the thing I almost got in error there before. But we were both able to have it. He worked on his Whitmore type of rearrangements, and actually that was entirely based on his experience of Jones. Whitmore's chemical theory taught at Harvard were nil. He was putting out these things, you know. He put a proton onto an alcohol and get an olefin out of it, and if you take the right one where there wasn't any hydrogen next door, the methyl group wandered. Well, I was at an ACS meeting where he actually gave that as a talk. At the close of the meeting, he was asked by somebody in the audience, you haven't used the word carbonium ion there, but aren't those carbonium ions that move? Oh, no, those aren't carbonium. He knew that Jones had a hydroxamic acid in which a radical moved, but he had taken an anion lost an anion, which means there was no actual charge that was created or lost. But in Whitmore's case, he put a proton on a neutral compound, and he lost a neutral compound, so he had to have a plus no charge, but he didn't know that. He just rationalized from Jones's type of rearrangement to his that they were both neutral.
How long did he stay at Northwestern?
He hadn't learned how to count electrons. Well, he actually soon learned.
How long did he stay at Northwestern?
Oh, from about for about 10 years. The last 2 years he was here, though, he was primarily in Washington, D.C. as head of the National Research Council Division of Chemistry. But he actually appointed a committee of three of us, Hines, Evans, and Hurd, and he hadn't ever thought too much of Evans, and Hines hadn't ever published anything, so he had me be it sort of an executive secretary on matters that had to be treated. We handled everything except the pocketbook. He came up here when he had to talk to the dean about money.
What did he do to convince you to move from Illinois? What was his selling point?
Well, as I recall it, I don't know if he telephoned or wrote a letter. I think he wrote a letter. And probably it was the higher rank and higher pay that persuaded me. I actually started out at Illinois at $1,800 a year. That would be small chicken feed today. Hiring anybody.
What did he give you here when you started at Northwestern?
God, I think I got 2,400.
That's a nice percentage increase.
Yeah.
And when you came here then, were you teaching primarily organic?
Yes, that's right. I had the elementary course and usually also an advanced course in the year.
What was Whitmore like to work for?
He was a hard worker, and he expected hard work of other people. From that point of view, he was easy to get along with. I think if you hadn't been an equally hard worker, though, he would have pushed you along into it, or at least their tribe to. We had some persons, though, that were not really, but they were older than he was.
At the time that you were starting to teach organic, and you just commented about Whitmore's not being able to count electrons.
Yeah.
But the whole Lewis concept was still pretty new at that point.
You mean G.N. Lewis?
G.N. Lewis, yes, I'm sorry, Lewis. Yes, G.N. Lewis.
Oh, that was brand new.
And
right.
So it...
Terms like leaving group had never been coined yet. And the octet theory of G.N. Lewis was really brand new.
Did you introduce that in your teaching?
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you remember what text you used in your first... when you first started up here?
I think it was Norris.
Okay.
Or Perkin. I had Perkin and Kipping in college. You probably have never heard of it, but it's a British text and a good one.
Is that the Kipping of the silicone? There was a Kipping in England who was some early silicone.
Right? I think so, yeah, yeah. But I think that I used the text by Norris, which really was terrible there in terminology. I recall at an ACS meeting once when F.B. Daines was the chairman. He was a grand old fellow, really, from Kansas. And at the end of the business meeting, he said, Are there any other comments? And there wasn't any at all. After half a minute, I said, well, how would it be if we'd have a committee to study improvement of nomenclature? Well, Daines was very sympathetic to that. Probably he'd had the same trouble with textbooks that needed some improvement. And he passed that idea on to Whitmore, who was the chairman then of the organic division. Well, Whitmore passed it on to me. So I became the chairman with a committee of one there to do something about nomenclature.
And that committee existed a long time, didn't it? That committee existed a long time.
Well, it certainly did, yeah.
How sympathetic were other organic chemists to your attempts to sort out nomenclature?
Well, I tell you, I started out by taking a whole lot of texts and journals, sort of thumbing the pages for words that were used for certain structures. And if they deviated from what I thought they ought to be, I'd put them in a list. And I had a list of about 100 names that I mailed to approximately 100 organic chemists that I thought well of, asked them if they had any comments, good or bad. I was amazed at the almost uniformity of the fact that they said this is the type of thing that we ought to do. So, to answer your question, I kind of had them be a party to it. Found out what they thought, and they all thought it pretty well. I think most of them were pleased they didn't have to be on a committee.
Did organic textbooks change as a result of this? Did you make an influence on them, authors?
I didn't ever there study it from that point of view. I would study a text reasonably carefully if I thought I was going to adopt it. Mm-hmm. But after I was up here for a period, I didn't keep on teaching the elementary course too much.
I still have Aldous catalog number 3 corrected by you.
Number three.
One and two were just one page circulars.
You had indicated to me earlier that Dr. Hurd would up until just recently was still correcting the nomenclature.
Oh, yes.
Well, actually,
it was a month ago that you were to be about the actor. Remember isonitriles?
You know, though, I think you have done more to do good nomenclature than you possibly think you are.
Well, we have
because of your catalog and your good use of names in your bulletins that you publish.
You don't know how often I have said to our people, boy, what Charles Hurd would say to that, change it.
But Eastman Kodak isn't that careful.
Well, if I had $20 billion in Camelot sales, we wouldn't be either. It was Union Carbide that had lots of bad names.
Certainly was. That's right.
But why is that? I mean, I've taught some elementary organic to nursing students, and of course you deal with nomenclature.
That was the first course I taught here, and I came up in the summer session. I had a bunch of hospital nurses. They worked all night. I had them at 8 o'clock in the morning. They were half asleep. I had never taught such a course in my life. Did you also have that experience?
Yes, it's an interesting group of people to deal with, that's for sure. But there's an interesting relationship there with nomenclature, because many of those students don't see a need for studying chemistry, and yet nomenclature in terms of the drugs and everything else they have to deal with, I think, is very important. And I always try to impress upon them this idea of how much you can get out of a name by looking at a name and understanding something about its the structure and also what it might do by the nomenclature. And I still to this day in a hospital, somebody wants to give me something, I make sure I read the label too and not just
they make mistakes.
And that was one of the things I was trying to tie to them, was this importance of nomenclature. And
well, would you call the word aspirin part of nomenclature? Or would it have to be the actual name that's also on the bottle?
Yes, no, I agree with it, that aspirin's not a nomenclature in that sense. But in this exchange you just had about people publishing things that are careless about nomenclature,
to me,
that was one of the fun parts of organic chemistry long ago when I was a student. And how important it is to be able to convey something through the right name.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you have companies who aren't doing that, that aren't paying attention to what they're publishing, it can create difficulties, I would think, too. That's why I said you were struggling with nomenclature back in 1922 in your PhD thesis. You were.
Well, I had no help, so I had to do something.
Did you get to Europe at any time?
Mm-hmm.
Did you travel to Europe at all?
Did
you travel to Europe in those days?
Have I?
Yes.
I have never gone to Europe. What's over there?
Well, you know, a good many American chemists did go to study in Germany or England.
Yeah. Well, I didn't have the money to do that. I stayed home.
You were in this, I'm not clear on the dates, between assistant and associate professor. You started you started here as an assistant professor in 24. And
sure, yes.
And then when did you get promoted to associate?
I think you're 28.
1928, okay.
Yeah.
That's the one date I didn't...
And I got to be a full professor, I think, about 32 or 33. And then about 1948 or 9, I became Morrison professor, that I could only keep 2 years. I was told I had to give it up. For I had the name, the title given in place of an increase in pay. I have to be more professor.
That was a common tactic in academic institutions.
And 2 years afterwards, however, I was told to give it up, and I would become the Clare Hamilton Hall Research Professor of Organic Chemistry for a considerable increase in pay. The PPG company, Clare Hamilton Hall, was a former Northwestern chemistry major about 1900 that became an officer in the PPG outfit. And at that time I was consulting for PPG when this paint and varnish division was up at Milwaukee. And the head of it was Howard Gerhardt, who was who's one of our PhDs. And he's the one that told me earlier, ask one of your officers, I ultimately asked the vice president, Peyton Wiles, to approach the PPD, PPG people for some cash, because they had some at the University of Chicago that they were not going to renew. And probably if they were approached, it might come to Northwestern, which it did. And Gerhardt also there saw to it that I should have a new title with some increase in pay, which is also a PPG grant based on that aspect of it, I think. I had an idea it was going to be given to the department for departmental use, but in place of that, it was given for a professorship.
We mentioned your book on the pyrolysis of organic compounds earlier. That was 1929.
I think, isn't it pyrolysis of carbon compounds? Maybe it's organic.
It might be carbon.
Yeah.
Were you approached to do that, or did you start that and then approach a publisher?
I started that, and then I asked Julius Stieglitz at the University of Chicago, who was the head of the committee that decided if those books would be ACS monographs.
I see.
And he apparently was happy to do it. And that was a long job of writing.
Well, you've done a lot of that. I wanted to...
Well, I tell you, to actually do that, I started a course here for graduate students on the decomposition of compounds at high temperatures, which I didn't know anything about. And from Monday at 9 o'clock until Wednesday at 8 o'clock, I was just having to work terribly in order to get what I was going to say on Wednesday. But it was that kind of thing that made it possible to write the book.
I see.
When did you get into sugar chemistry?
Into what?
Sugar chemistry.
Well,
it's a long way from pyrolysis.
I was a consultant for Corn Products Refining Company, who actually there gave the university some cash with which to do some work on carbohydrates. And that was to me. I could pick any topic I wanted to, providing it was something having to do with carbohydrates. And that is how I got into carbohydrates, with money. That crash stuff, you know.
Yes, you had your first paper in 1932.
Okay.
Pentose reactions, and the student that was working with you was a Quaker Oats fellow.
That's right.
He was supported by Quaker
Oats. Eisenhower, wasn't it?
Well, I'm not sure which.
Well, it's immaterial.
But then you did, that same year, you had a pyrolysis of furan, which was also developed from... So you were still getting your pyrolysis work in. You also, back in 31...
Well, I had some help from Quaker Oats, too.
Okay.
I was consulting for them, which didn't have anything to do at all with what I was doing some work on. That is, I didn't ever do any problems here that were part of company problems. I'd just take a trip and talk to them on the company problems. But it was easier to get some cash if they knew you and if you knew them to do some actual work, and that's I asked for it indirectly a few times, but usually, well, for example, like Pabst Brewing Company gave me some money for carbohydrate work too. That was because of Carl Miner. Miner was a consultant for Pabst, and he also was a consultant for Corn Products. And it was his influence that he said, well, look, why don't you give Herd some cash to keep on doing the work? He's publishing some of the pages, and you'll see, and this will help him do more. But he was really a really great friend, and also a tennis player with a court up there north of here. His home was either Winnetka or I think there's the one north of that. Name is Glencoe, that's it. And I was invited to play up there pretty much, and we got to know each other better that way than just by means of chemistry.
I don't think Professor Herd can have realized how much chemists in these companies looked forward to his coming, because in many companies, PPG for instance, the chemistry was not particularly good. Mm-hmm. And you were the one bright light. You would come and spend the whole day there, and one could talk chemistry to you, and you would understand.
Yeah.
Christensen, the lawyer, for instance, didn't understand.
Well, as a matter of fact, that was true with quite a lot of companies.
I'm sure.
Yeah. They ordinarily had a plan, sort of planned out in advance what we might take up. And then I'd be steered to various people to talk to on that idea. I'm sure that taught me as much as it taught them, if not more, because you have a perspective that you just don't ever get if you're not part of a company. That is, in other words, what PPG was doing. I wouldn't tell anybody else, but it would direct my thinking in a lecture that I was going to give. And I think the companies knew they could talk to me freely. If they can't, you're not much of a consultant.
You also had some work published in 1931, which was supported by Midgley and Webb of the Ethyl Corporation on the pyrolysis of lead compounds. How did you make that contact?
Well, by way of Thomas Midgley. I don't quite know how it started, but we had really quite well correspondence. And probably I could hunt up my old notes, and if I haven't, we'll toss them out. But he knew me, and I knew him.
I see.
And he had some cash with which he was able to direct my way. I didn't ever ask him for that, though.
Did that come about because there was some concern about the public health with decomposition of tetraethyl lead at that time?
I don't think so. But I just can't recall. Perhaps it's organic mercury that we had at Northwestern. How about some organic lead work here? I think there's more on that kind of basis.
I see. I also wanted to ask you about something that I had not known about till I read the paper you wrote about the Institute of Chemistry.
Oh, yes.
Whitmore had the first one, ran the one here, I think, which was the second one.
Do you recall the name George Rosengarten?
Yes.
He was quite a wealthy man, I think, in the East with an industry, I don't know which one. But Whitmore approached him to have something that would put our name forward. That is, in other words, Whitmore was a booster trying to get people to realize that there was a chemistry department at Northwestern. Well, he started this Institute of Chemistry, in which he gets some well-known speakers to addressed the crowd that came during the time, and with the second one, he went to England to get Sir James Irvin here for the whole 6 weeks of the Institute. Well, that was really a scoop. Whitmore had to go to Scotland to get him, and he was happy, of course, but it was not because of hubris. It was because he was boosting Northwestern. And he was that kind of person. Lewis could never have done it, and I could never have done it.
Wasn't Whitmore's nickname Rocky?
Yeah.
Where did that come from?
Frank Clifford Whitmore. I haven't any idea.
I just wondered, because I've heard him called that.
That's right. Rocky Whitmore. Probably a Harvard nickname or something, but I don't know.
How long did that Institute of Chemistry last?
2 years.
Just the 2 years?
Yeah. And it simply died a natural death.
Given the attempts of the ACS today to try and promote chemistry again, why it would be, and looking at the program, it was quite a program of speakers. And wasn't part of that also public recognition of chemistry, not just within chemistry circles, but wasn't it also partly to get public recognition of chemistry?
At the Institute of Chemistry,
yes.
You mean? No, it was more to get public recognition of Northwestern University.
Okay.
That was what was in the back of his mind.
Was the department growing under his leadership?
Well, not tremendously in size, but it certainly did expand every year. Yeah, it was sort of a slow development. But keep in mind, it was zero about 1920.
That's right.
And the thing that we actually had to do to get graduate students was teaching assistant pay and fellowship pay. Once in a while, you'd get one that would pay his own way, but very rarely.
What kind of students were you able to attract?
Only the better ones. The best of them.
How many PhD students did you have, all in all?
Total. You mean at that time?
No, in your lifetime.
Oh, how many have I had?
Yes.
Oh, I'd have to add them up, but probably 100 or so. All that I could do would be to go through my old notebooks and see what the names are. But the easier way would be to take the papers that I've got and read the titles and add them up. They aren't all in the postdoctoral category, but most of them are.
Most of you, or all of your graduate students, did have papers then.
Yeah.
As you see, you have other cases like Bob Woodward, where many worked with him but got their PhD but no paper.
Well, no. I wasn't that way. That is, in other words, I would try to make a paper out of a dissertation and put it under that guy's name, with mine attached.
It's much fairer that way. Yes.
Well, I had a purpose in putting my name first, because if you want to hunt anything up, it's my name that people could find.
Sure.
If you have the other preceding in an index, you've got a terrible job.
It's very frustrating in the older chemical abstracts to see that.
Yeah.
You look for someone and it says C, and then you have all these other names you have to look for.
And as a matter of fact, I'm the one that had the problem they worked on in the first place. They just did the work.
Did you assign problems, or did you allow students to select problems?
Well, I would offer probably three to choose from if they wanted to work with me, mm-hmm. and they would pick which one of that they wanted to do. Would that be an answer to your question?
Yes.
Sure.
To have them come and tell me that they have a problem that they want to work on, that almost never happens. Not by my choice, but they don't have problems.
Did you have postdocs in those days?
A few, yeah. And some were pretty good, some weren't so good. But I think there are more of that category now than there were then, percentage-wise, I mean.
Who were the best student you ever had?
Hmm?
Who were the best student you ever had?
Oh, there are half a dozen I could name. One was Max Pollock. One was Paul Austin, who, as a matter of fact, was not one of my PhD boys. He took a undergraduate work at Madison, Wisconsin, and there's a poor bachelor's in chemistry because he thought about it too late. He arrived with really a bad preparation. He was here under me, that is, I had an application, I had some cash. He worked that year, but he couldn't pass the master's exam. He went to Cornell the next year, and I told him next year at Cornell to take it over again at Cornell, which he did, and he passed. But he's a pretty high-class individual. Do you know of him?
No, I don't.
Well, I've got a paper here that I think I can find somewhere.
It'd be nice if we could look forward to being 94 like that.
Oh, yes. Yes.
He has a sea grant to do some work on clam shells.
Very interesting.
How's that for an organic chemist?
That's interesting.
I at least knew that it was in my office somewhere. But
one of the things that I also wanted to talk to you about was your involvement with getting that organic model kit produced. Evidently, that was born partly out of your frustration of teaching stereochemistry or three-dimensional structures to students.
That's right. And because Toy Tinkers was here in Evanston as a company that made toys. And I even had them spend about 3 weeks thinking that they could make these, but the problem was all that they knew how to do was to drill a hole straight through. And they supplied us the pegs practically at cost, and they told us, the person in Maine, to hunt for how to get the balls, because those were the balls that they used, except they weren't put in properly. But I actually there had the original idea, but about a week later or so, Wallace Broad and Cecil Board at Ohio State approached them on the same problem.
Really?
Yeah. And they called me up. And, I said, I know them. Let me get in touch with them. Well, they ultimately turned the project down. And they said, if you want to do it on your own, why, we'll be happy to and the pigs to eat practically at cost. I don't think they want to lose money, but they didn't want to make any. And Wallace Broad went to Maine to spend about a week there with the people that were drilling holes and taught them how to drill tetrahedral holes. But it was a godsend in teaching. I don't have any idea what's happened to it. We actually there kept it up as a company for quite a number of years. Didn't ever make money. Our idea was to have it be so cheap that you could insist that the students actually buy one. And we put it at about $1 a box. And the profit, I think, was about 2 cents.
How did you market this? Did you have a name for it?
Molecular Models.
I see.
That was a name that's on every box. I have some yet here.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. And who handled all the paperwork and the ordering?
That was done at Columbus, Ohio by somebody that they hired, I guess, and then the cost was split three ways, or at least I assume it did. I at least had some that I paid when they told me how much it was.
And then, sorry, that's the same thing that Sargent took over in, what, 1949?
Yeah, that's right. Like you have actually there seen that box, haven't you?
Well, I have a Sargent box from years ago that I picked up.
An oblong one, about an inch high? Yeah, well, that's probably exactly the same box, providing it has printed on it the word Molecular Models.
Well, this one the one I have is a Sargent one, so it's later than the early one.
Yeah.
Did you ask your students, tell your students they had to buy one of your kits?
Certainly did. And what made that profitable was because of the large number of students at Ohio State. Ours had to have it here, but ours is trivial compared to them because we don't have agriculture, we don't have the big engineering courses that they do, and we don't have very many chemistry students. I mean, they're compared to them. Ours added to it, but what they had was a big bunch of sales. And we purposely, though, purposely devised some experiments to do in the laboratory with those box of models. In other words, we could insist that they do it, and by observation, we were in the lab to see to it they did. And with that help, we hoped that they would have it help them in the textbook stuff. But I just didn't ever have any problem with stereochemistry after that.
You have someone at the door.
You're right. There are to appoint two scholars for senior research at Northwestern bearing my name, which each one all of the departments that are interested will put in the name of the best candidate that they're offering, and they'll pass it on, and a committee will pick two out of that list. They'll get $500 a piece.
Supplying the funds. Hmm? What you didn't mention is that you are supplying the funds.
Hmm?
You are supplying the funds.
Well, part of it anyway.
Could I keep this for your file?
No.
Is that the only copy you have?
That's the only one I have.
Okay.
Well, I can make a little copy of it if you want one.
All right. When you have it sometime, I'd like to put that in the file.
Okay.
We were talking about those molecular model kits. Did you sell them to other institutions? Did you advertise in Journal of Chemical Education?
I don't think we ever advertised. I think there's correspondence with professors that we knew,
mm-hmm.
and we told them that if they were interested, let us know and we'd send the right amount to them. On that, the details of that, though, were pretty much with board and road.
Okay.
I'm happy I didn't have it.
How did they compare with the FISA models? You know, Louis FISA also wanted them as cheap
well,
as possible.
These were first.
Sure.
After you put out something, then some other people can improve on it. You have seen these, haven't you? These old molecular models?
We have the FISA.
You haven't.
No, but have you seen the earlier ones?
Certainly.
Well.
But in those days, Aldrich couldn't sell them because Aldrich didn't exist. You have to tell us at lunch. You can join us for lunch, can't you? You have to tell us why you think Döring was.
Well, I don't think he was. So this was, yes, this one still says manufactured by molecular models.
Yeah, and but this was after
Sergeant
after we got out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have any idea what happened to him now.
Well, I think you can still buy them. I think they're still in the Sergeant catalog.
I see. Well, as a teaching device, I'm going to have to ask some of our teachers if they ever use them anymore or what do they use. Because it was a godsend to me to have this for carbohydrates and proteins.
Excuse my moment again. How did you get Sargent to take it over?
I think they asked us.
I see.
But I'm not positive about that either.
Discovered it before you got home.
Yes, yes. It's always there. Maybe we could talk some more. I have a long list of things here in terms of the chemistry that you had done. In keeping with this more general line, you were listed as one of the co-founders of the Journal of Organic Chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
And you had written something, well, you wrote something with about Morris Korosh, and
ought to have a reference on it, but in essence, I actually raised the question here, who started it? And I came to the conclusion that it couldn't be anybody else but M.S. Korosh. He put some cash in it and all those things, and then he apparently invited the people that would be on the editorial board. I was one of those. Starting it, however, 100%, I think, was Morris Korosh.
I see.
You can't have that. Look at it.
All right. What was your role, though, beyond being just one of this list of people?
Well, once in a while we'd have editorial board meetings in those early years at a time when there was a convention. I was at, I think, about three or so of them. They ultimately quit. Small became the editor after the first one. I think the first one was Reinhardt, wasn't it?
Yes.
But it, Koresh, I think, felt the need of the fact that there was only one place in the country that you could get organic papers published, that was the JACS. And he thought that that was bad. And he decided to do something about it. And he, I know, tried hard to get Roger Adams to do it, but Adams said no, he didn't want to have that kind of work. But a person that was important on it was Marvel, who was practically Adams' right-hand man. And it was just simply an outlet for organic papers, of which up until that time there was only one, and he thought there ought to be at least two.
And this wasn't ACS published at first.
No, this had nothing to do with the ACS.
Did it, what was it, the University of Chicago Press publish it? Was that? Somewhere in Chicago, wasn't it?
I think it gives it there, but I can't answer that question. Publication wasn't one of my worries, just the address where to mail it was.
You also had one of his nephews as a graduate student, didn't you?
Yeah.
How did that? Was that through your connection with him, or did
probably
he just,
that is, Morris and I are pretty good friends, and here I'll put down the floor. And the one that worked with me was named Norman. He's out there in California now. He was going to get his PhD at University of Chicago, and Morris said, "No, you're not." So he's the one that aimed him up here.
I see.
I think he kind of felt that would not be a good place for his nephew to be, as if they might talk favoritism or something like that, you know. But he was a pretty good man in his own right.
How would you rank the? Let me rephrase the question. In all the years you were teaching organic chemistry, what were the major changes that you saw in the way in which you taught organic chemistry?
I don't know if I had any. Probably if I teach it today, I teach it the same way I did then. No, that kind of thinking. Oh, obviously, if there was something important that was new, you'd try to work that in, but you'd always have to take out something else. And you could mention a thing incidentally very often. Well, for example, in penicillin, I could have spent a month on that or an hour. Well, I put an hour. But there's a carbon up there with an oxygen and a nitrogen going off from it. And that's all. All the rest are carbon bonds or hydrogen bonds. Well, I'd ask him, "What do you think about that? What does it look like to you?" I was hoping that somebody would say aldehyde, because that's the way an aldehyde structure is. Two of the four bonds go to something that's negative. And I told him, if you know that, you can predict that that's where it ought to hydrolyze, can't you? Well, it's that kind of thing. If you can weave the fundamental story into a particular structure, the kids begin to get the handle to it, and then that puts them in a place where they can do a lot more with it. And all of them are very interested in seeing if they can be taught something about things that are in the papers these days. The papers don't do a very good job of it. The papers, incidentally, are beginning to get a lot of criticism, or at least the chemists think that papers are treating them unjustly, because, well, I recall that Roald Hoffman in Hawaii about 1988 talked about chemophobia that's coming over because of the press. That's the word he used. And well, about 2 months after that, also in CNEN, there was a person that had analyzed a large bunch of newspapers for how they treated the word chemical. About 80 to 85% of the time, he said, it's as damaging or dangerous. That is, in other words, in the press, chemistry is not given a good name. Well, it doesn't make news. News is if you've had somebody eat some poison or something. Yeah. And from that point of view, I've completed putting an article out that I think I may pass to CNEN, see if they will print it. It would need a large publication. The idea is a chemist has to talk to a non-chemist if you're going to improve something about chemistry. Well, what do you say? If you start with vitamins or something like that, you just can't make it interesting if they don't know any chemistry. It's all the papers do. If that's all a chemist could do, it's stupid. So I've got a paper coming out that I'm putting a title on, The Other Amadeus. How we can let Avogadro help the image of chemistry. It was Amadeo Avogadro. And Amadeo is the Italian equivalent of Amadeus in Austria. Of course, I point out that the first Amadeus is Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, that everybody knows because of Peter Schaeffer's play and subsequent film, Amadeus. But I think that one of the very greatest chemists we've ever had, because he's the one that told people how to get molecular weights accurately, is Amadeo Avogadro. And you can tell it to a non-chemist perfectly by just defining the word element, atom, and molecule. Avogadro is talking about molecules. And all of that, well, you can point out that the same molecules of hydrogen and oxygen in the same volume were way different, but they got the same number. And then I developed that to talk about air. I think that this may interest you. A weather prophet on TV will tell you that if the barometer is going to get lower, it increases the chance of rain, but he doesn't ever tell why. If you'd ask him why, he'd probably say, because that's what I actually was taught in school, which of course doesn't say anything about why. Well, I developed the point that in a mercury barometer about that tall, it's held up in that small column by hundreds of miles of air in an imaginary column of the same diameter. In other words, it's sort of a seesaw, balancing. Well, let's argue that the pressure changes from 31.5 inches to 28.9 inches. What makes it go down? Or something in that air makes it go down. It's water vapor. In other words, water weighs 18 compared to air that weighs 29. In other words, 28 is N2 and 32 is O2, and it's about a quarter oxygen. So 29 is roughly what you can use with air to do that. If you'd have a bowl in your kitchen that is dirty and you wash it, you put it upside down in the rack to drain. After it's drained, ought you to leave it that way or ought you to turn it right side up? That's your kitchen now. How could Amadeo help you on that? You turn it right side up because now you're talking about gaseous water rather than liquid water. It has to evaporate with a molecular weight of 18. And, well, a thing like that is thoroughly understandable to a non-chemist. And if you're going to talk to a non-chemist, you've got to be pretty careful or you'll get into a subject where you just can't talk about it, too complex. But I think that's the way to improve the image of chemistry, though, is for a chemist to talk to a non-chemist. You could talk about your company in a way that is chemical but interesting. I wouldn't be able to, but you would because of because of your knowledge. And have you also thought that the papers are doing a bum job for chemists, or have
you? Absolutely. Hmm?
You think so?
Terrible.
Yeah.
Not too long ago, we had headlines in the Milwaukee Journal that they found 2 pounds per billion of benzene
yeah.
in a well.
Yeah. And that gets in the air.
Yeah.
As a chemical.
Yes.
Well, the advertising for products is all... Hmm? The advertising for products, for food products.
Yeah.
You know, all natural, no yeah. chemicals.
Yeah.
And
which
this
is
kind of thing, sure. Potatoes, no cholesterol, no fat. But it's the way to sell.
You did a lot of writing for encyclopedias,
mm-hmm.
and I'm just following up what you're saying now, because you were doing that in a certain sense by writing for encyclopedias. How did you make that first connection?
It was, I think, through Austin Patterson, who was a chemical historian, more or less, and writer, and we actually knew each other pretty good. The biggest job on that wasn't encyclopedia, it was dictionary.
I was going to ask you about that.
I had done that type of thing for the small Random House dictionary that came out earlier, and then Merriam-Webster asked me if I would do it for their third new international dictionary. I thought to be maybe a trifle harder than the other one, so I put the price up a little bit, but I put it up to $3,000. Hardest $3,000 I ever earned. I thought it'd take me my spare time for a year. It took it for 10 years.
Well, there was, what, 20,000 terms?
Yeah.
I mean, how did you manage that?
Well, I'd go on. What they did, they actually sent me 60 steel boxes about this long that would hold 3x5 cards. Cards is a sorry term. Half of them were on India paper. There were a lot of cards there. Well, the word acid would have about a foot of cards. I'd have to define the word acid by considering every one of those cards, because it's got various uses. I mean, various meanings. And but I would take those cards, for example, on a consulting trip with me on a train or airplane, and I'd take about the number that I thought maybe I could handle on the trip, and up at Ephraim, Wisconsin, where I have a summer place, I'd take those cards up there in one of these boxes and do it up there. But it was spare time work that was very, very wrong.
You still go to Ephraim every summer?
Well, 2 years ago, I was not there. That's the first time I missed. I was there for a very brief time this year. You see, I am up there by invitation now. I don't own it anymore. Well, I gave it to 3 people, my son and his 2 daughters. And it's easier. It would be much more difficult if I hadn't done that while Mary was alive. That was easy to do then. Now I'm discovering that with her, about a year gone now, there's a trust into the will, and it's impossible to do that without a lawyer. They sort of see to it and tie your hands, but it apparently does save tremendously on the person that actually gets the stocks or money or whatnot afterwards.
We were talking earlier about the different kinds of support that you had from the API and from Quaker Oats and Corn Products, but during World War II, you did work for the Quartermaster Corps and I've got notes here on some of the others, but you also did some mustard gas work.
That's right.
For the Chemical Corps. How did, when after World War II started, how did that happen? Did they come to you because of your previous work?
I think it happened because I was in a group at a chemical meeting where there were quite a number of chemists that were well enough known to direct some projects, and I was in that group, and we all more or less sort of applied at the same time to the same people, and we'd have some cash allocated to us with which we could hire some person to do that kind of work. And that was all there was to it. That is, in other words, the war was on, and this was a group that thought that the chemists ought to have some participation in the research work that was simply underway. And it turned out that I hope it helped. I don't know.
Was that work done up here? It was done
at the front here. It was here in private. That is, in other words, that was one of the things I could not talk about, which I would not have ever taken at all in peacetime. And then after the war was over, why, I was asked to continue, but it was on a basis that I actually could publish.
I was wondering about that because one of the papers were published in the late 40s. 5-6 years after the war was over before some of these papers were published. So,
yeah.
But that wasn't really necessarily the work that went on during the war, but the continuation after the war.
Well, perhaps it was even there during the war, too, because many of those papers after the war was over were cleared for publication.
I see.
But they had to be, however, cleared because the promise was you weren't going to talk about it.
Did you have graduate students working on those problems?
I think mine were all postdocs.
That would make sense. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, that's true.
One of the things that strikes me as I look down your list of publications is the incredible variety of
incredible
work. Well, I think it's you. I can go talk about a few of these, but you.
Toy balloons and filtration.
Yes, toy balloons and filtration. wasn't that, I remember that one. It's,
I have a feeling that I did not expand that into 10 pages.
So, but you started out in pyrolysis, and then you were in carbohydrate.
No, I started out in ketones.
Ketones, okay. And then pyrolysis.
Then pyrolysis.
And then...
But on that, one thing led to another, you see. Ketones was a lot of high-temperature stuff I had to work on and discover, and that said, well, God, if you can heat acetone, why can't you heat ethyl acetate or something? And it was just sort of an ordinary development after that. And then, as you've indicated, carbohydrates came by a grant from, with the help of Mr. Miner.
Yeah, sugar chemistry and pyrolysis are about as different as two fields could be. Sugar chemistry and pyrolysis are as different as two fields could be.
Oh no, I've got a paper, thermal decomposition of sugars.
Oh, yes. Somebody burnt it, you know, a cake.
But you are, however, correct, as always.
No, but you see, there was one school of sugar chemistry at Ohio State.
Yeah.
You know, that really concentrated, and then you came along, and it really...
But the aspect that I had was entirely different.
Sure.
But it was to treat organic, I mean, treat carbohydrates not as natural products, but as organic compounds. There are a whole lot of reactions that had been completely skipped. Because
now they're chiral building blocks.
Hmm?
Now they've become chiral building blocks.
Yeah.
You, well, for example, you just mentioned a few others. Then, as I mean, you had a paper on carbon suboxide. You had a better method for making carbon suboxide.
Well, that's the ketene.
But that's part of that work.
Yeah.
Bleaching powders and ketones.
Charles L. Thomas, that I just got full communication from this last week. I don't know how that started.
You did some ozone analysis.
I think it was because of some levulinic acid that I got tangled up with.
Quick oil.
From a Quaker Oats. That is, I knew that it was going to become commercially available, and so I began some project on levulinic acid, and probably the bleaching powder came indirectly as a result of that one.
Remember Johnson Wax buying the patent? Levulinic acid.
I was purposely careful not to tell the president of it, who had also a place up at Ephraim. I knew him.
Well, it was so funny because as a salesman from Quakers was going north, Johnson Wax, Milwaukee, 3M, and within a week or 10 days, he told three of us, and he was a ketone, and of course motherhood, to make the bisphenol from it.
Yeah.
And there was a long fight, you know, a legal fight.
Yeah.
You did some work on ozonolysis.
On ozone, yes.
Yeah. Ozonolysis, the triple bonds.
Yeah. It was impressive to me because I was using ozone for different purposes, and then I happened to realize that this had never been done, so I did it.
You did something on the structure of cyclooctatetherine.
Yeah. Not much.
Was it in connection with Koch's work repeating it?
I don't know whether he was first or I to get the print on that, but the two projects were different. And I don't recall too much of what I actually did. It was coping, not very important in my work.
Cope and Fenton have repeated Wolfsbettel's work.
Yeah.
You know, Taylor had published in the early 40s,
yeah,
thinking that such after such, I mean, that Wolfsbettel never had it.
Well, I actually began it from that point of view to find out if I could get substantiation or not, and I think I completely was able to prove that he had it.
Yeah. But unbeknownst to you, Pepe had made many kilos at the body ship.
Yeah.
Um, 1941, you published a paper on the structure of diketene from spectroscopic evidence, and you measured absorption spectra.
Yeah.
I was curious how you measured the absorption spectra, because what type of it was UV, if you were down into the UV when you were looking at that.
Well, we had a spectrophotometer at the university, and
The reason I'm asking is that this is the 50th anniversary of the DU coming up, and it was unveiled in 1941, and you published paper actually prior to the time the DU was available. So I was wondering what kind of instrumentation you had to measure UV spectra at that time.
Well, I can't tell you.
Okay.
If you'd ask a physical chemist over there, they could answer it, because That's the way I picked the instrument up, with some instructions as to what to do.
Okay.
Well, until the early 50s, there was doubt where the double bond was.
Hmm?
Until the 50s, there was doubt whether the double bond of diketene was inside the ring or outside.
Yeah.
Until Gutowski and Bethe published the NMR spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
That was the first use of NMR to determine
with you.
Simple molecule.
You also had a patent, chloroisoprene, 1942.
Good for me.
Commercial Solvents Company.
Yeah.
Are you doing work for them?
I was a consultant there. Yeah.
Okay.
And the patent was to them. Of course, there is no such company now. It was taken over by IMC with their division, Pittman. Well, at Terre Haute, people don't actually call it IMC, they call it Pittman-Myers, is that it? Pittman. There is a division of IMC, and that's it down there that used to be Commercial Solvents.
But in reality, you never got many patents.
You have a few, but
not too many patents came out of your consulting work.
No. Oh, total maybe 10 or 12. There is a patent that I should have taken out.
Oh, really?
Making ketene from acetone.
Union Combine would have to pay you a lot of money.
Well, that's the way the acid anhydrides are made. Acetic that was the thing that Union Carbide said, well, it looks as though this guy Hurd didn't patent this, did he?
Had you thought about patents in those early days?
No. Patent was a complete stranger to me.
And there was certainly probably no patent agreements with the university.
Well,
in those early days.
If there is anything patented here now, the university wants to be the one that it's actually assigned to.
Right. But in the days when you came, that didn't exist.
And I didn't have any patents at all that I patented on anything that I was doing privately. It's only these industrial contacts where I had an original idea. Therefore, the patent was in my name. But if there's any profit, they got the profit. I don't think there are ever very many profits. It's about 100 patents to one that pans out, isn't it?
The early 50s, you did some deuterium tracer work in pyrolysis, too.
Yeah.
That was pretty early on in using deuterium tracers, wasn't it?
Well, I had help on that because at that time, a professor here is Malcolm Dole, who was doing work on isotopes. He incidentally died only a few months ago, but he was, I think, probably the most important physical chemist we had here. And a very nice fellow. I'm the godson, and for a Baptist that is something. We don't have that word of his son. I mean, I'm the godfather of his son. So he and I thought pretty well of each other.
I know you had a paper. I thought I had written it down here with Arthur Frost.
Yeah.
And I was going to ask you about Frost because I know that's how I learned my kinetics was Frost and Pearson. So.
Yeah. Well, he's in Arizona, and Pearson's in California. Both of them alive yet, but both very smart boys in mathematical part of chemistry.
Is Max Pollock still living?
Hmm?
Is Max Pollock still living?
Oh, yes. Yeah, he's in the metropolitan area, in the New York area of New Jersey. I think it's Morris Plains is where he lives. Very charming wife, also alive.
Also very good chemist. He's old.
He is.
Yeah.
Oh, do you know him?
I know of him.
Yeah. Well, he actually did some tremendous work with me there. There's a person from Canada that did very good work with me, too. Oliver Ted Edwards.
He is retired now at Carleton University.
That's right.
We visit him once a year. He worked with Marion. On Sussex Drive, you know, National Research Council.
Well, and I wouldn't know that.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, very nice fellow and a good violin player.
Is that right?
Yeah.
He's a very nice guy, but he's retired practically.
Yeah, he has retired, I think.
Yeah.
But isn't he up there yet at Carleton doing some private research for us?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Which means he isn't retired except on the payroll.
Yeah.
Well,
got a very nice lab on the fifth floor with Al Simon. Did you have many Canadians?
Well, there's one at Nova Scotia now. And Edwards? No, I did not have many, but
who was
I had
at Nova Scotia.
God, I know it as well as I know my own name. Right now, I can't think of it.
No, Taylor.
Hmm?
Taylor?
No.
A woman, did you say?
No, it's a man.
No, I see.
And I think he's going to come and call on me here this June or so. He's got an aunt that lives in this area. God, doesn't that drive you nuts? Wait till you get to be 93.
Don't have to wait. I'll remember now.
Austin. No. Well, it'll come to me. I know how to look it up anyway.
We can always, well, we can add that in later. Yeah. Look at the transcript. You evidently did collaborate a lot with your other, with other people in the department. You mentioned the paper with Frost, and you had one with Irving
Cloverland Croach
on an infrared paper, infrared of some polypeptides.
Yeah.
You did the deuterium tracer work, so you were really quite involved with your colleagues here.
Well, you have to be broad-minded.
Can you tell me any more about how that, how the department has changed over the years as you watched it change?
Well, yes, because I'm over there at least every Tuesday noon for a bag lunch, and I think that's the reason we've got such a good department. We've been sort of choosy in who we hired, and if we didn't think they'd grow, we would tell them so in the first 3 or 4 years they were here, and they could look elsewhere. But they would not get promotions here. But we've only had about one or two of those. But what the bag lunch does is one person on the faculty is talking to the rest of the faculty, telling what he's doing. All the faculties there, physical, organic, analytical, bio, except bio now is pretty much absent. They're their own department now. But telling what they're doing and knowing that their time is coming up sometime during the year means that they've got to have something to say. And I'm impressed that we've got a very, very good department.
How will the lecture?
The soul over there has brought the inorganic thing. I think you can talk to him.
Yes.
Well, he started out when inorganic chemistry here was pretty thin. Well, I think it's probably the biggest of our divisions now over there. Honestly, it's a powerhouse we've got over there in organic. I don't mean that organic is poor,
right,
but I think that the inorganic is better. With Ivers and Van Dyne, there's a group over there that I don't think can be matched.
Keeps you young, anyway.
Yeah.
How good was the lecture last week? I'm sorry, I had to miss it.
Well,
board meeting.
He brought out the fact that the Dow chemical company is pretty big. I hadn't realized that they are the biggest producer of polyethylene and polystyrene in the world, which isn't bad. But he's pointing out a pile of other things where they're having plastics do the work of metals. They even have a plastic automobile engine. He indicated, though, in the talk,
that one of the polymers that he had kept at 350 degrees for a period of time, happened to lose about 1.3% of its weight. Well, I talked to him at the end of the talk. You actually told that this polymer lost that much on heating to 350, but you make an automobile engine? Well, he said, that also does lose weight.
I'm afraid they have treated chemists worse than any other company.
But they're putting out automobile bodies of plastic that are gorgeous things, and I guess pretty big business for them. At least they were pure white. I asked him afterwards also, you indicated these automobiles were made out of carbon polymer, but pure white? I thought carbon was black. Well, he said, it actually is. We put epoxy coating on the top of it that's white paint. No, I was impressed that he had really quite a lot there of good stuff to say. It's an impressive company.
You were very active in the Chicago section.
Well, for a period of time.
And you wrote for the Bulletin for many years.
Yes. It's always been an active section, and I'm positive it is yet, but I don't take evening trips anymore, and I'd get lost in the loop in Chicago, I think.
You're not alone.
Well, we talked about your nomenclature work. In that paper in JCHEM-Ed, you mentioned the problems you had with, was it Hudson?
With Hudson, yeah. He was a stinker. He's a genius in carbohydrate science, but his particular problem was Isbell. Isbell is a chemist that worked with Hudson for a while, and Hudson had put out some rules for carbohydrate chemistry, and Isbell offered to improve on the wording of one. Hudson didn't want to have anybody improve him, so he just got down to something terrible. Well, Isbell is prominent in carbohydrate chemistry. He worked at the National Bureau of Standards, and he became the chairman of the carbohydrate division and put out a symposium on carbohydrate chemistry, and he asked me to give a talk, and that talk was on carbohydrate terminology. And there was a committee. What was the history of that? There was a committee formed of carbohydrate nomenclature after that talk, and Isbell appointed me to it. He was the chairman, and the fact that Isbell had anything to do with it put Hudson also against me if I stayed on that committee. Just incredible. He and I had always been compatible. He came twice, as a matter of fact, to see the carbohydrate work that I was doing here.
But the instant that I stayed on anything that Isbell was on, my name was Nuts. But I was glad to be able to tell people that, because Isbell couldn't.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I imagine it would have been difficult.
Mm-hmm.
That would have been difficult.
Yeah. Both Isbell and Tipson were involved, and both of them gave me a tremendous thank you after my talk. They said, well, we both stood up to the great man, didn't we? Absolutely pointless.
I guess it's difficult when you have a man whose chemistry is so good. As you said, his science was very good. But
just like an 8-year-old boy that can't have his own way.
You ever run into that very, is that an unusual event in your long career of interacting with people?
Well, he's the only one. That, in other words, you ordinarily can converse with people that you know something about, and pleasantly, it's always been that way.
You should read the papers that Kolbe wrote against Kekulé.
Yeah.
How can they get an idiot like that, recto and bon?
Yeah.
Well,
time for lunch.
I've run out of my questions, and I don't know if there's anything else that you would like to add at this point.
Well, I can indicate one thing that perhaps you don't. You aren't aware of, in my protean work, that's an addition to my work on molecular rearrangements, because if you have a carbamic acid hydrazide, it will rearrange in the same way and you make polypeptides that way, by a way that does not start with an amino acid. It starts with the half ester of a malonic acid that you convert to a hydroxamic acid, and it's a kind of an ingenious way to do it, but it's an outgrowth of that work on hydroxamic rearrangements. I don't know of anything else that's of any interest, except that I haven't wrecked my Broca's pods out there yet.
Dr. Bader, is there anything you'd like to add before we close?
We came here purely for the enjoyment.
Came up here to hold her wife's hand, I can see you.
I admire the man for 41 years. You don't want to miss that opportunity. And I can't tell you how I looked forward to your visits to Milwaukee. You were the one man I could talk chemistry to.
Yeah.
Earl Parker I couldn't talk to.
Who?
Earl Parker, for instance.
No. Well, he was about the best one otherwise, though.
Yes.
But He wasn't in your category.
Anyway, there must be a nice place to have lunch.
Who's that person that sort of headed it up? A pleasant fellow, but I couldn't talk much chemistry to him.
Dr. Christensen?
Hmm?
You mean in at BBC?
No, Christensen, he was pretty good, I thought.
Yes, but in raisins, not in chemistry.
Yeah. No, he isn't the one I had in mind. I'd know it if I heard the name.
Gloyer?
Who?
Gloyer?
Not Gloyer.
Is it Gloyer?
Name one more.
Henry Vogel?
No. Well, it's immaterial.
Moffat.
Hmm?
Moffat.
Moffat was from Northwestern, so I already knew him.
But he wasn't interested in chemistry, really.
No,
we're all interested in politics.
Yeah. Well, BPG was very helpful to Northwestern.
It would have been helpful to me.
And very helpful to you, too.
Well, with that, I'd like to thank you very much for spending the morning. I've enjoyed it immensely.
Well, I've been very glad to meet you. May I take your pictures in the middle between those two charming people?